Hey, if you're enjoying this show, consider supporting us on our Patreon. You can get cool perks like access to these episodes a week before they go public, and you can pick an album for us to review. Any support is greatly appreciated, so if you feel inclined, go to patreon.com/polyphonicpress.
You're listening to Polyphonic Press, a podcast for music lovers. Join your hosts, Jeremy Boyd and John Van Dyke, as they take a deep dive into a classic album and analyze it track by track.
Hey, welcome to Polyphonic Press. I'm Jeremy Boyd.
I'm John Van Dyke.
And let's hit the button and see what album we're going to be listening to this week. So we're going to be listening to Arcade Fire and their album Funeral.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm actually not that familiar with Arcade Fire. I know a couple of their songs. I know a few of their songs that are on that are played on the radio.
Yeah. I know my sister's has this album somewhere. So I've heard bits of it, if not all of it, at some point. But I haven't paid that close attention to it.
Yeah. Okay, so Funeral is the debut studio album by Canadian indie rock band Arcade Fire, released on September 14th, 2004 by Merge Records. The album produced 5 singles with Rebellion and Lies in brackets. I guess that's their biggest hit, Rebellion. I know that song. Mm-hmm. And it looks like this is a bit of a concept album, because there's a few tracks on here that, or the first part of it is, I guess it's one song. I'm not really sure. It's one song divided into 3 parts. It's Neighborhood Number 1, Neighborhood Number 2, Neighborhood Number 3, Neighborhood Number 4. So 4 parts. That's pretty interesting. And it's self-produced, so there's no producer on it. I'm actually curious about this. Okay, so let's hear the first song, which is Neighborhood Number 1, an alternate title, Tunnels. All right, so that was interesting.
Mm-hmm.
It was busy. There was a lot going on, but I think it filled out the sound really well, I think.
Yeah. I thought it was interesting. Like, you've got the main hook played by a piano, but there's another piano. They're just faintly in the background doing this, like, I don't know, tinkling, just, like, constantly in the background for this. And it just sort of adds the atmosphere that they want in the back there. I thought that was kind of cool.
Mm-hmm. The one thing I didn't like about it, and I don't know if that's just because for the past little while we've been listening to albums that came out, you know, before the 1990s, but it feels like this was mixed in a way where everything was being pushed to the max. It didn't feel like there was. It didn't feel like there was. It felt like every instrument was kind of maxed out.
Sort of fighting for attention there.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think with the exception of that one piano on the back, which was way down in the mix. Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of things did seem to be up there. It wasn't the worst thing.
No,
I don't think it really suffered from it. But I do notice what you're talking about. And yeah, that is since 1990, everything, been kind of like that. Oh.
Yeah. It's just the loudness war and it's just the way it's been mastered. But it was a bit of an adjustment because, like I said, we, for the past, you know, several weeks, we've been listening to albums that came out before the 90s, and now this one is like right in the middle of the I don't know, it's 2004, but it's right in the middle of the loudness war. Before, I think it started to ease off around 2010, around there, And I think now things are mixed a little bit more.
Gone back more, to some dynamics.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I did notice that in this, the guitar part, I mean, it's really not an obvious thing, but you can sort of hear it's like this sort of like distorted, and again, it mostly sort of plays the same hook in places where the piano's not playing it. But it sounds like it's got this, I don't know, it sounds like it's in the background, but I think that's like a reverb effect. But it's also not particularly loud in the mix, too, so I'll give him bonuses for that. But yeah, the drums and the bass in the background are just way up front with the main piano lick and the vocals.
Yeah.
I don't know if that was an obvious choice or just because that's what the production was doing at the time. I don't know.
It could have been just like it was the trend at the time, and because this is the start of, this is sort of the tail end. Remember in like 2003, you had the garage rock revival, and that was considered the indie rock.
Yep.
And then a little bit after that, indie rock sort of became its own genre, and it became this kind of stuff. This like, not that I'm saying
the collaboratives and stuff like that, where you had, these guys, and it was Canadians really led the way on that with like Arcade Fire and the New Pornographers and other bands like that. And of course, the Great Lake or Broken Social Scene and the Great Lake Swimmers and stuff like that, where they were really the, and I think all four of them are Canadian.
Mm-hmm.
Most of them are like collectives of musicians who had other projects and stuff like that, and it was almost impossible to get the full lineup on a tour at any given time. But at some times that was sort of like a blessing, because there was always some other musician who was part of the collective who could step in to do something if another member couldn't. So they could be like consistently on tour, or you know, as close to as possible, while other bands attached to them are also doing other things at the time. So I think it was almost like a creative decision, but it was also like an economical decision.
Yeah.
In some way, although I imagine it was really expensive for divvying up royalties.
Yeah, it would be. Yeah. Not exactly a get rich quick thing. Yeah. I kind of miss those days.
Mm.
But moving on to the second one. This is Neighborhood Number 2. Alternate title is Laika. I think that's how you say it.
Yep. Laika was the name of the dog, the first dog in space.
Oh, okay. Yeah. That makes sense. I didn't know Arcade Fire could rock.
Yeah, I did, because I'd have heard this before. Yeah. So.
No, I like that.
Yeah, it was pretty fun.
And again, but
sometimes the lyrics can be a little unintelligible with the effect on it, but it's a neat effect, but sometimes it helps having the lyric sheet in front of you.
Yeah, it's like a distortion almost, or... And they kind of
singing through an old bullet mic or something like that. I don't know.
Yeah. It was interesting. And I'm liking the drums in this. It's the drummer is sort of using the tom toms in place of the hi-hat.
Yeah.
And it gives the drums this boomy sort of sound, and I thought that was interesting. I don't get the sense that this song was recorded live. I get the sense that it was sort of built up and overdubbed.
Could have been, yeah. Yeah, I think it probably was. Again, this is, it's a collaborative, and they might not have even been all at the same, in the same studio. It could have been whoever was available that day, come and do their part, or email me your part, or, you know, something like that.
Yeah.
Here's the track, email the part, come back, we'll stick it in Pro Tools, and here's what we got.
Yeah.
Because this is the debut album, so they probably had no idea this was even going to go anywhere at this point.
Well, no.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's just one of those things that goes, yeah, I don't know, let's just do what we're going to do.
It might have even been sort of one of the very trendsets. This is like 2004. This is like right after bands like, you know, the height of, you know, the White Stripes and the Black Keys. And so, well, actually, the Black Keys got their most famous later on, but they were doing stuff at this period. But they were kind of underground still at this point. But that garage rock thing, like the Vines and the Hives and stuff like that, that real push, the peak was 2003, and then this album came out, and it kind of changed the focus at that time. So
yeah, and then you had bands that you had all the Arcade Fire copycats, like
of course,
I don't want to name any names, but you know, there were I, and I'm not,
what
I'm
does
not
it
saying,
rhyme with
sheet boxes.
No, I
don't have anything against Fleet Foxes, but it, and I'm not saying that they copied Arcade Fire or not, but there, it was
but a lot.
I think the record companies set out to sign bands that sounded like them.
Yeah, absolutely.
Or, you know, because they saw the trend. Well, I don't think they saw the trend. I think they created the trend, because we all know how much control
a record becomes a trend when they find a band that sounds like something, and then they expect everybody else to do the same thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's been going on since the beginning
since
of rock
the record
and roll.
Companies had control over such things. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's go on to the next one, which is a French title. It's called Une Année Sans Lumière, which roughly translates to
the
My
night
Dog
of the
Has Light. Arthritis.
It's the, no, the it night of the light.
It's the night. No,
one year without lights.
Yes.
Wow, I was way off for some reason. I can read French. I honestly can.
Yeah.
A little bit.
All right, here we go. So that was a lot more stripped down than I was expecting. Yeah, and but I kind of, it looks, it just, I think these guys know, they know what they're doing, and it this doesn't feel like a debut album in the sense that they'll take a song like this and they'll recognize that, okay, we have all these instruments, but this song, we don't need to use them. All we need is a bass, a guitar, bass, and drums, and a keyboard, and vocals, and that's all we need for this song. And whereas a lot of bands, and it not only that, but this album is self-produced. So a lot of bands would maybe, if they're working with a producer for the first time, would have all these crazy ideas and, you know, put on all the instruments that we have and everything on every song. And a producer would go, wait a minute. Let's just focus and take each song one
Don't
at a time.
It.
So it's I'm impressed that these guys have the maturity to recognize
the restraint.
When, the restraint and mm-hmm. to go, okay, well, we can have a grand epic song with all these instruments, but we don't have to do that every time.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm kind of blown away by that. The fact that this album is self-produced and
they didn't just bog everything down with, yeah.
Yeah, it's self-produced, well-produced, and it's their debut album.
Yeah. You know? No, I agree. I don't have a lot extra to say on that. I am noticing it was stripped down, so the fact... And everything was still basically front and center. There wasn't a whole lot of difference between, you know, the levels and stuff like that. But again, it was so stripped down, it was not necessary to do anything like that.
Right.
Everything fit nicely at the front. So, yeah, that's basically all I have to say on that one. It's a decent song.
Yeah.
It was interesting how they were decided to do like a French-English sort of cross thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, they're from Montreal, so yep. that does make sense that they would mm-hmm. add in a little bit of French in there. But the other thing that's interesting in the song that's coming up is how this album is structured.
Yeah.
So you have the first two tracks, which are part of the Neighborhood series, I guess, and then it deviates from that, and then it goes back to the next two tracks. So,
which are also Neighborhood 3 and 4, yeah.
Neighborhood 3 and 4, yeah.
It's almost like a concept album.
Yeah.
I mean, it might be a concept album. I haven't really paid that close attention going through it, but it seems that there's a theme going through it.
Yeah.
I notice a lot of things. It seems a carrying theme seems to be like sort of a nostalgia for youth, maybe. I mean, with the tracks, Neighborhood and stuff like that. So mm-hmm. I'm noticing a lot of that so far.
Yeah, I do too. Just kind of looking back, and well, the song Leica, that was kind of about the Russian dog, I think.
Could have been. I think there's it's one of those songs where it's got like multiple layers within the meaning and stuff like that, where really you could put your own meaning to it as well.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. But let's get back into the Neighborhood.
Yep.
with Neighborhood number 3. An alternate title for that is Power Out. So that was a lot more synth heavy. That kind of reminded me of like Nine Inch Nails or maybe Depeche Mode or something like that.
I heard a lot of U2 in that one.
Actually. A lot of U2 as well, yep.
Yeah. It was a lot more string heavy. There's a lot more guitars and basses going on in it.
Yeah, but I'm just thinking like it's in a minor key, so it has that darker sort of almost gothic sound to it.
Yeah. Yeah, I sort of hear that sort of like industrial Nine Inch Nails sort of thing going on in it.
Yeah.
But I did hear, I mean, some of U2's stuff, like when we go back to the other album we were listening to, yeah, they could sometimes they had like pretty dark subject matter sometimes in their songs mm-hmm. and stuff like that, and the music reflected it as well. And but U2 also has this tendency to have a little bit more of an uplifting sort of sound to them, whereas this was definitely more of a darker thing going on.
Yeah, with U2, I think it sounds it's sort of like the lyrics and the melody, or the lyrics and the music are sort of counteracting each other, so you'll mm-hmm. have like dark lyrics with in a major key or yeah. something like that. Whereas I think it's sort of like dark lyrics and also in a minor key, which kind of
Yeah, it gives
gave it
that
gothic sort of sound to it.
Yeah.
But yeah, you're right. I mean, they're not
copying one or the other. They're doing their own thing.
Yeah, exactly. It's adding the guitars in there and everything, which you wouldn't necessarily hear in Nine Inch Nails. They're there, but they're not, you know, they're not those the clean sort of guitar tones that you heard on this.
Somewhat clean. It was
somewhat
sort of
clean.
It was like a dirty dark guitar tone, but I don't think it's because they put anything on it. I think that's just the guitar they used. I'm not sure what it is, but it had this real dark twang to it or something like that. It might have been like an old harmony or something like that.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. I don't know. I like the song. I thought it was
I think this one might have been a hit. I'm not sure.
That's
maybe it's just because I heard it.
Well, all the neighborhood,
the whole neighborhood series were
released as singles.
Oh wow, okay.
Oh, I don't know if they were big hits, but they were released as singles.
But I think I heard them on the radio. I know I heard them around the house quite a bit. Mm-hmm. But I'm pretty sure I heard them on the radio.
Yeah, they probably would have been. Well, I mean, if they're released as singles, they probably would have been played on the radio at some point.
Yeah.
So, moving on to the next one, we've got Neighborhood Number 4, this is the last of the Neighborhood series.
Far from the last of the tracks on the album, though.
It's called Neighborhood Number 4, and the alternate title for that is Seven Kettles.
Time keeps creeping through the neighborhood, killing old folks, waking up babies.
So I like that the acoustic guitar was sort of front and center in that. And all the instruments were creating these textures, and they weren't very distinct. You could hear what they were, like you could hear the accordion in there and things like that.
Yeah, but they weren't shouting for attention.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, it was just like an atmosphere for the guitar line, which almost sounded like a child's play sort of a kid song sort of thing to like sort of drift through or something like that, and that sort of created this interesting juxtaposition between these two moods, where everything else going on in the background is very moody, but the guitar line is almost naive sounding, kind of going through. It's kind of neat. And then the lyrics, of course, are talking about, you know, He mentions like the idea of having kids or, you know, he hasn't got any kids, but he plans on it. And I think he's a little bit, he's talking about how he's not sure the world is a place where he wants to raise them.
Yeah.
That sort of came about in a few sections.
Yeah, it's sort of like the, I never thought of that, but until you mentioned it. But yeah, it's almost like the guitar is the child, and the sort of the other textures is sort of like the dark cloud of how the world really is, and how the child is sort of opening up and sort of blind to the real world, but it's still there.
Yeah, it's a looming presence, whether the kid's aware of it or not, or some sort of thing. I don't know. That is quite a that's my sort of take on the song. Anyway, I guess it's yours as well. I thought it was sort of interesting. All the orchestration, which, I mean, this is not, they didn't hire an orchestra. These are the musicians they know coming in to do stuff. And that's where it really pays to know a lot of different musicians from a lot of different musical backgrounds and who can play a lot of different instruments. So
one of the visuals that I get, especially in the beginning when it, I don't know if it was the strings, but it was this like a screeching sort of sound a little
bit.
Yeah,
I think that was a fiddle or a violin, I guess.
Yeah. It's the image that I got in my head was sort of, swings on a playground.
Mm.
I don't know if that's what they were going for, but that's kind of the image that I got.
It could have been like, it could be sort of like a childlike nod again with like sort of like the swing thing. I don't know if this is intentional or not, but it could also be sort of like that screeching, you know, horror movie trope of either like, you know, where squeaking door hinges or, you know, a squeaking swing set in like this real desolate sort of park sort of thing.
But I didn't get a haunting feeling from it. I got of like it was like a joyful like swinging, although it was slow. It wasn't like a
no, but it played with the other atmospheres going on in the background. Yeah. So I'm not sure. I mean, it could have been, but yeah, it's hard to say.
Yeah,
it could go either way. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, exactly. And maybe that's intentional. Maybe it's the
ambiguity of it all.
Ambiguity and the unsure way of... Yeah. So the next song, we're getting out of the Neighborhood series and into... Well, I'm sure all the rest of the songs play into the overall theme of the album too, but the next song is called Crown of Love. So I think that might be my favorite song on the album so far.
I was thinking the same thing. That was a really good lesson. I'm not normally one for ballads because most of them are really like syrupy. That was a good lesson in how to write a really good ballad. It's got like this 50s, 60s almost structure to it. But it and it was chock a block full of emotion, but it wasn't sickly, sappy, sort of. Which a lot of them can be. This actually had, I don't know, again, the darker undertones that give it this, you know, weight to it. Yeah, that was a great song.
Yeah. Well, this is how I kind of see it. I think this song is telling the story of a relationship, a romantic relationship from beginning to end. And here's why I think that. I think the first part is like you said, kind of sweet and kind of sappy, but not really. It's the honeymoon phase of the relationship when you're, you know, you're really into each other. And then all of a sudden there's a change. And the, not only the tempo, but the mood changes. Like the first part, it was played with a bit of a swing and that kind of 50s sort of feel.
Yeah.
And then it goes into just a straight feel. And it's the strings in that were really the ones that were telling the story, because in the first part, the strings were really nice and mellow. And then in the second part is they were very chaotic and very tense and full of anger and hurt. And I think it's the fade out was deliberate, because it's just when you break up with someone, you have that feeling, and then over time it just kind of slowly starts to go away and you kind of let go of it. That's the image that I get from it.
Hmm.
I could be totally wrong.
I don't know. Yeah, it's sort of interesting. Like, most of the song was like the ballad, and then it turned into like that sort of rocking, up-tempo thing when it sort of decides to go out. It was just sort of like, I mean, you might be right, but I was sort of thinking of it. I would think that you would do that like through the different through the different verses of the song or something like that, where each verse was like a different portion of the relationship, whether they're singing about that or not. But something would sort of like, you know, carry those moods through it. But it seemed like most of the song was, you know, honeymoon phase, and then the rocking part. It's really, I don't know if it was it's part of the song, but it's not like part of the structure, like the meat of the song. The meat of the song is like this ballad.
Yeah. So
I don't know. I think that was just like an outro. I think it was more of like a musical decision to do that more than a storytelling. I don't know.
But, yeah, that's possible.
Either way, it was a really, really good song.
It was really a good song, really well put together.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and so and I always liked, or I always like string sections that are really present in the song. Mm-hmm. There's a song by what's that band called? Noah and the Whale. There's a song called "The Heart of Nowhere," where the main instrument is, or the main instruments is a string section. And it's one of my favorite songs, so
that's cool.
I always like that.
Yeah. Yeah, it can sometimes go either way. Like sometimes a string section just sounds like a production decision that's like made to sort of like, I don't know, appeal to the I don't know. It's trying to make it like, not in this case. This is, I mean, the instrumentation again. This is they are part of the collaborative. These are musicians. They know they're part of the band. They came and do their the parts that, you know, whether they wrote them or not, I don't know. But anyway, they're part of that creative process. I find that sometimes when you take an orchestration and you sort of tack it on, I mean, it's kind of like the Beatles' Let It Be album, where they never meant to have that orchestration in there, but Phil Spector took it upon himself to throw it in there and sort of almost appeal to the base that buys albums that wind up in, you know, Value Village record sections that no one ever wants.
And that's not to say that a nice string arrangement
can't
work, like on the Aretha Franklin album.
Absolutely.
The strings worked really well on that.
They can be, like, again, they can be really, like, a deliberate... I've heard them used in really, really wonderful places, but yeah, sometimes it's like an overproduction thing where it's just, well, this sounds like a departure, like the musician, the main musician, the main idea is so buried in, you know, orchestration and other things like that, where it just kind of feels, it actually kind of drains it of its original message and emotions and sort of stuff. You can go either way. But yeah, no, it fit perfectly with that track.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
That has a strong contender to be my favorite song.
So far, I think it's my favorite.
So far, yeah. So the next track, moving on to the next one, is called "Wake Up." So that kind of bookended the previous song, with the previous one starting out with the 50s sort of feel, and this one kind of ending with that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I wonder if that was deliberate.
I don't know. I always felt like that song to me, I always, for some reason, when I first heard it come on, I remember the song, but I thought somehow I remembered it being like an intro song or something to like the album or something like that. It was like, unless it's like, maybe it's like the second side or something like that, but I don't know.
Well, this was released as a single, so you might have heard it on the radio too.
Yeah, this might have been any other. Was it maybe? I don't know. They didn't release singles quite the same way. Because they don't have to send out 45s. I was thinking, was it like a flip side to the other to one of the neighborhoods, or was one of the neighborhoods a flip side to that, or I don't know.
I don't know.
But they didn't really do that. Although you could still buy a single of some of these things.
Yes.
This was the period where vinyl was making its resurgence.
But I like that song.
Yep.
And I can see why it would be released as a single. Definitely works that as a radio song.
I like how the guitar hook is so simple but effective. It's one chord played, and then until it goes to another bar, and then it changes the chord. But it all is ba na ba na ba da 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 da, and it's just the one chord. But it's so effective; it doesn't need to be anything more than that.
It's all in the rhythm.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. That's why. I mean, that's why Bo Diddley works so
exactly.
Well. He can just play one chord, but it's all in that. In the rhythm,
or John Lee Hooker, or I'm trying to think of some of those other Delta Blues guys, like R.L. Burnside or somebody. They sort of do the same sort of thing. They pick a chord and they sort of go. I forget. It was either R.L. Burnside or I don't know. One of those guys was saying, "It's just like, how come all your songs you only use like one chord? It's just like, well, I don't know, another chord, that's another song."
yeah
And I think he was partly joking, it's amazing how effective simplicity really is. It's not at all complicated to play, although you have to have a certain sense of rhythm to play it. There's nothing complicated, and it doesn't need to be anything more complicated.
Well, I mean, that's the old saying. For rock and roll, all you need is three chords and the truth.
Yep. And the truth is the most important part of it.
Yeah.
It's the most important part than the three chords.
Yeah.
Yep.
I mean, it can get very elaborate, and that's fun, but you don't need all that.
Nope.
We have three songs left. And the next one is called Haiti. So maybe it's because we just listened to it and it's fresh in my mind, but I think that song could easily fit on the T-Rex album.
Huh. Interesting.
I think that's
interesting.
Maybe it's the acoustic guitar and the same chord changes that Mark Bolan would use.
Maybe. That's not what hit me at all when I was listening to that. I'm not saying you're wrong. I think that's a very interesting take. I might have to listen to it for that again, but
yeah.
I'm not hearing it yet.
Okay.
But that's, that's sort of interesting. The song is clearly, it's clearly about Haiti, which, I mean, that poor country cannot catch a break. It's as relevant now as it is, as it was then. This was obviously after that major earthquake hit them. I mean, they'd just been hit by another earthquake, and their president was assassinated, and there's like a huge amount of refugees trying to get into the States and yada, yada. Yeah, it's just, man, I mean, it's just right in the line of fire for just, you know, it's like geographically, it's like the worst place to be.
Yeah.
As far as, you know, any upcoming like sea rises, I don't even think they want to think about that yet. They got enough problems on their plate.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's,
but you really get that that feeling, especially with the sirens in there. Where they're,
mm-hmm.
This must have been like right after that major earthquake, where their Capitol building was like, it looked like a big abandoned. It looked like, you know, ruins of some ancient civilization. It was really crazy.
Yeah, yeah, I remember that.
Yeah,
yeah, that must have been around this time, 2004.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a good song.
Yep.
Yeah, I don't have much more to say about it. Yeah, and it just hit me that it sounded like the T-Rex. And yeah, obviously about that earthquake that happened. I'm curious what year that actually was.
I'm assuming you're looking it up.
Yeah. Well, there's been a lot of them.
Yes. Like I said, they can't catch a break.
Yeah. There was one this year, actually.
Yes, there was. That's what I was saying. They've just been hit by another one.
There was one in 2010. Yeah.
But the massive one was around this time, though.
Yeah. I think. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, where basically the entire country was shaken. It was quite devastating. And I don't think they've ever really recovered from that. And the country wasn't exactly rich to begin with.
No. Well, I mean, how could you recover from something like that that devastates your whole country? I mean, where do you even begin to rebuild?
Well, they were trying to rebuild, but again, financially, they got huge hit.
Yeah.
Again, I think there was still a lot of infrastructure damage from that, whereas a richer country would have rebuilt by now.
Yeah,
I mean, 15 plus years later. But yeah, I know. But they keep also get slammed with more and more and more. And how can you keep up when that keeps happening?
Exactly.
They're just in, like I said, geographically, they're just poorly located. Mm-hmm. And a lot of this is like recent, you know, changes in the climate that create these problems. I mean, we could go political here, but
yeah,
that's not what the podcast is about.
Right. But it's the song, that's what we...
Yeah, exactly. It is kind of... It ties into that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway,
moving on. This song, Rebellion, alternate title, Lies... probably the biggest hit that Arcade Fire have had. This is the song that broke them into the mainstream. So, and I haven't heard this song in a while, so it'll be interesting to hear this one again.
Yeah.
So, here we go. That's such a good song.
That's a really good song, too. Another really one that stays relevant through the days, through the years.
Yeah. You know what's what I was thinking about when I was listening to that is, so maybe it's an independent record thing, but first of all, this was the fourth single released from the album.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the biggest hit that Arcade Fire had.
Yeah.
It's also the second last song on the album.
Yeah. Which is like that never You don't hear about that usually. That's a very unusual placement for a number one hit. A number one for the band hit. For a hit in general. Doesn't usually come that late in an album.
Yeah, it's... I think it's the record company just saying... Because usually a record company might... I can't say for sure, but they might say... You know, they would need a hit within the first couple of songs on the album. And so if you're an artist trying to, you know, sequence the album and figure out, you know, which order the songs are going to be in, knowing that going in, you would have to sort of place what you think is the best song towards the beginning of the album.
Yeah.
But they didn't do that. They had a concept in mind and they wanted to tell this story with the first side of the album.
Yep.
And the record company said, okay, whatever you guys want to do.
It was independently released. So,
it was on an independent label. They were signed to, like,
Is this Arts and Crafts?
The album. It's Merge Records.
Oh, Merge Records. Okay. I think Arts and Crafts came along later.
Well, Merge Records in the States, and then Rough Trade in the UK. I don't know. Merge Records, they must have signed to an American independent company.
Yeah.
That's the difference between a major label and an independent label.
Absolutely.
An independent label will support the artist and just say, okay, yeah, you guys know your music better than we do. So you guys do what you're going to do and we'll help you along in any way we can. Whereas a major label will try to see where the record is going to make money. And if they don't hear a hit single within the first few songs, they'll actually choose not to promote the album and it'll tank and then they'll drop the artist from the label. I mean, that's an extreme example, but that's the sequence of events that, you know, typically happens. I mean, that's a very common story.
Yeah. It's sort of sad because honestly, I think every release that a record album or a record company puts out, they should promote at least to some degree every record that comes across their thing, because it shouldn't be their decision what survives and what doesn't. It should let them go out there. People will latch on to the one that they want to listen to. One will surface to the top. I don't understand why they feel like they have to be, you know, they have to pull the levers on this sort of thing. I mean, when the labels were first starting, they basically were throwing whatever at the wall and seeing whatever stuck. And honestly, they should still be doing that.
Yeah.
That's what the independent labels do. That they just go, okay, cool. There's another album. We've got like 700 here that we're putting out here. These guys are going really well. And these guys are doing really well. These guys are really good, but they're still very underground. But we're hanging on to them because they're really good.
Yeah.
That sort of thing.
Yep. It's the record industry is a weird business.
Yes, it is.
It doesn't run like any other business.
The industry around art, and it doesn't matter what kind of art, is totally corrupt and totally takes advantage of the artist completely. Because the artist is a type of personality that they just want to do their art. They're not necessarily the, you know, the right brain, or I mean the left brain sort of, you know, business minded, technical sort of thing. Very few artists are all that competent in that, in those sorts of affairs. And the people around them, unfortunately, it seems to be the trend. I mean, not everybody is this, and I'm not saying every left brain sort of mathy kind of person is going to be like this. But unfortunately, the industry is built up of, you know, the artists who create the content, and then the other individuals who are the more business savvy, who have a tendency to take advantage of these people because they know they can.
Yeah.
And it's really sad.
Yeah.
But yeah, designers have the same problem. Yeah. And any sort of, like, you know, illustrators and things like that. How many times do people say, oh, well, your job is fun, therefore why should I pay you?
Right.
And they get caught up into these, situations where they're trying to just get a basic paycheck for art that they've already done.
Yeah.
So,
well, and the film industry too is
film industry
so bad. I mean, how many over the last decade there's been so many remakes and sequels to old movies that came out like 20 years ago.
Well, I know.
Or more. Simply because the studios know that they can make money on those.
Exactly.
They can bank on nostalgia. Where's the next Martin Scorsese or...
they're out there, but you know, again, they got a slog.
But they're not going to have their money, have their movies widely released.
And this isn't even touching on the fact that the actors and actresses and other, you know, even costume people and stuff like that, they're all getting the shaft half the time too. I mean, It took a really long time before, I mean, as annoying as sitting through credits is sometimes, if you go back to like what they call the golden age of cinema back in the black and white days where there wasn't an inch of gold on the screen, just saying. it was all silver, sorry. Yeah, where the only credits were generally the producer, the director, and then just the top, I don't know, seven cast members who were the people that, you know, were considered important enough to have to be listed. And that was usually at the beginning of the movie. There was no credit list at the end of the movie half the time anyway. Sometimes there was, but... generally, yeah, fade out, the end, people march out of the theater, that's the end.
That's it.
That's all she wrote. And these other people weren't acknowledged at all. So that's why you have such a long list of credits, is because people fought for those.
And it's not just about getting acknowledgement. It's not just seeing your name on the screen. It's about getting paid.
It's about getting paid.
If you don't get a credit on a movie, you don't get paid.
Exactly. And that's it's a legal contract is what it is. That's signing your name to the movie. That's your signature on there.
Yeah.
It's important. Where was I also going to go with this? Oh, I was also going to mention how the song, when it started up, sounded... it's another track that really reminded me of U2.
Yeah.
When it started up. The U2 is clearly
an
influence on this band, for sure.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that note after our rant about artists. Anyway.
So we have arrived at the final track on the album, the 10th track, which I think 10 songs is a perfect number of songs for an album. Not really. I don't care.
it really demands. Some albums are longer and they can keep your attention, and other ones have only a few. Like, good grief. Most prog albums had like 7 songs, but, you know, some of them are like 20 minutes long and stuff like that. But they can. But again, with only the 7 tracks, they can keep your attention. At least in the early days of prog. Some of the later ones, I don't know what you guys are doing anymore. But, yeah.
Yeah.
But no, 10's a pretty good average length on list.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's go.
Okay, so the 10th song is called In the Backseat.
Thank you.
So a little more psychedelic on the last track there.
Yep.
I think it
was a French horn I heard there at the end.
Yeah.
That was pretty cool.
It reminded me of something that could have been on like Sgt. Pepper or something.
Yeah, exactly.
Like that.
Yeah.
The instruments and some of the chord changes.
Yeah. I also thought it was interesting how they sort of played with the time signature a bit. Well, the time signature was definitely a 4-4 going through it. But at some point, they would just cut off one bar and launch right, you know, after 3 and then go right back into 4.
Yeah. So. Yeah, very interesting track. Very interesting album. I never had paid too much attention to Arcade Fire. And because I think by that point, I was still into the garage rock bands.
Yeah.
I wasn't.
Me too. I wasn't ready for that trend to die out yet. I was still waiting for the next White Stripes album to come around the corner or something like that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I was in the same boat.
Yeah, I'm glad. It's funny because I remember hearing some of the songs, especially the Rebellion.
Yeah.
I remember hearing it on the radio and watching it on Much Music and things like that. And so it is bringing back a little bit of nostalgia in that sense, just because I remember hearing these songs.
Mm-hmm.
But I never paid that much. I never paid close attention to Arcade Fire. And
I'm having a hard time, you know, believing that this was as long ago as it was. It really doesn't seem that long ago to me. But yeah, 15 years. Holy crap.
17 years.
Yeah, 17 years, yes, you're right.
Yeah. It's even longer than you think it is. I mean the thing is it doesn't sound dated.
No, it doesn't.
I find a lot of maybe it's I don't know what it is. Maybe it's because I kind of stopped paying too much attention to a lot of new music. But a lot of the music from like 2005 onward, there didn't seem to be that much. I'm not saying that it all sounds the same, but I'm just saying that there wasn't as much of a shift as there was, like, say from the 80s to the 90s.
Oh yeah,
that was a huge shift, like a complete change.
Yep.
There didn't seem to be that big of a change, and maybe it was more gradual, and I just didn't notice. But there wasn't that big of a change between, like 2008 to 2014 or something like that.
Mm. Yeah.
And maybe that's just because I was older and I wasn't paying that close attention to newer music.
Yeah, for whatever reason. I mean, I'm hoping there's some stuff in this. I kind of felt the same way. It was hard to really latch on to something. At that period, a lot of it was just seemed to be over my head. I'm hoping something in this list or this pile of lists that we've compiled into this random generator is gonna, you know, show me something a little bit different. And this album, I mean, some of these collaborative bands, like, I've always liked the New Pornographers. I always thought they were quite good, quite excellent. But yeah, some of that stuff really kind of was a little bit lost on me at the time as well. And, you know, I had friends that played music much like this, you know, in this genre. Mm-hmm. And I'd go out and I'd support them. And there's lots of good stuff for there. And yeah, I remember that only being, I guess that was about a decade ago too. The one show I was at in particular.
Yeah.
It's just, I don't know, too much time's going by too quickly.
That's what happens. You get, time goes by quicker and quicker and then you die.
Lovely.
it's going through these albums. These are I guess other than Led Zeppelin, these are all the artists are artists that I know and have heard a lot from, but never paid that close attention to.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of glad that we're doing this because it's opening me up to a lot of artists that I otherwise wouldn't have.
And
not,
genres.
Not that, that I wouldn't have heard, but I wouldn't have taken the time to appreciate and listen to.
Yeah. No, so. I'm kind of in the same boat. I like doing this. It's kind of fun.
Yeah. So yeah, on that happy note, I guess we'll end things there. Thank you. I just want to say thank you to anybody who has listened to these last episodes. We have almost, not quite, maybe a little more than 25 years worth of episodes to do. So this is literally just the beginning. There's over almost 1,300 albums that we have to go through. Yeah, so
we'll see if we'll even make it through all of them. Yeah. That's a commitment.
Yeah. Yeah, I just want to say thank you. If you want to support the show, you can go to buymeacoffee.com/polyphonicpress. You can donate a little something there. And you can, if you want to drop us a line, you can send us an email at polyphonicpressmusic@gmail.com. And check out the website, polyphonicpress.com. And if you are listening to this on Apple iTunes, you can leave a 5-star rating and leave a little review because it helps people discover the show. And yeah, that's about it. Unless you had anything else you wanted to say.
No, I'll just say, any interaction with the Pat podcast on whatever platform you're listening on is probably going to help really. I think sometimes even negative stuff will actually help in the algorithms and stuff like
that. Well, actually, that brings up a good point, because don't be afraid to give some constructive criticism, because we want to hear feedback about things that we could improve or we want to know what you think about the albums, what we talk about. We want to hear from you. So don't be afraid to drop us a line. That's about it for this episode. I'm Jeremy Boyd.
And I'm John Van Dyke.
Take it easy.
You have been listening to Polyphonic Press. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Polyphonic Press. Check out the website, polyphonicpress.com. Feel free to drop us a line at polyphonicpressmusic@gmail.com. And finally, you can support the show by heading over to patreon.com/polyphonicpress.